I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Democrats in the House of Delegates mustered just enough votes to override Governor Hogan's veto of a bill to give voting rights to felons on probation or parole, but the Senate postponed its vote for 2 weeks. We'll hear from a delegate who voted to sustain the veto and from an advocate and former felon who hopes to vote for the first time this year. Also, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world right now. Millions of Syrians have fled their home or been displaced within their country. Mark Ohanian of International Orthodox Christian Charities, based in Baltimore, just returned from Damascus. He'll tell us how Syrians are coping with the harsh winter. Then, news headlines from the Baltimore Business Journal and tips for keeping your pets safe in the snow. It's Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you're with us today. It's a Friday News Roundup. And let's just acknowledge what's on everybody's mind right now. Snowstorm! Later in this hour, the Baltimore Humane Society will join us with tips for keeping your furry loved one safe during the snow. Also, Joanna Sullivan from the Baltimore Business Journal will bring us up to date on recent development news and other news in the region. But up front, 2 days ago, the Maryland House of Delegates voted to override Governor Hogan's veto of House Bill 980 passed last year. That bill would allow felons to register to vote even if they're still on probation or parole. It takes 85 votes in the House to override a veto. That's just what the Democrats got. The vote was 85 to 56, with six Democrats joining all the chamber's Republicans voting to sustain the governor's veto. The Senate was expected to take up this override vote yesterday, but postponed its vote until 2 weeks from today. Senate Minority Whip Stephen Jennings asked Senate President Thomas V. Mike Miller why he was holding the vote so long.
Interesting date, February 5th. Is there a reason why we can't handle this bill now while we're here today?
Well, I think there's okay, you want her to respond?
I'd like someone to say. We have 46 members of the Senate right now. It's possible on February 5th we could have a 47th member. We're not waiting for that, are we?
Yes.
Thank you for your honesty.
Any objections to the... All right. Without objection, the bill's been made a special order for February 5th.
By February 5th, a new senator will have been sworn in, replacing Senator Karen Montgomery, who resigned for health reasons last month, and that will give the Democrats one more vote. Late yesterday, I spoke with one of the Republicans in the House who voted to sustain Governor Hogan's veto, Delegate Brett Wilson. He represents District 2B in Washington County. He's an assistant state's attorney in Washington County. And I asked Delegate Wilson if he views voting as a right or as a privilege.
It's not a privilege, but you have to look at where it is in the Constitution as well as the Maryland State Constitution. It's treated a little differently. And one thing that we have to acknowledge is that being a citizen, obviously, is one requirement to voting, but also being a good citizen at times is something that we can certainly look at. Now, there are two states that allow voting even from prison. They just don't take it away at all. Mm-hmm. I just believe that because, especially on the side of violent crimes, that where someone has made the decision to maim, to molest, to murder another human being, that comes with a price. And the price to pay, one price to pay, of course, is loss of your liberties. And one of those liberties is also a right to vote.
Delegate Wilson said he believes the debt to society must be repaid in full, that felons should serve their entire sentence rather than getting out early due to being paroled.
If we had truth in sentencing in Maryland, like they do in several other states, what you would do is when you're released, you have completely served your sentence. And I would have absolutely no objection that you would automatically be restored your suspended right to vote. They do it also in the federal courts where you are given a sentence and you serve that sentence. And there are, of course, there are good credits. There are other things that can reduce it from the maximum amount, but there's no parole. And remember, parole is a grant of freedom based on good behavior while you are inside. And I understand that. But because you're reducing, and in case of a violent felon, you could easily reduce a 10-year sentence down to 5 years or a little less than 5 years. Now, when we look at things from the victim's side, because victims have rights too. A person has a right to live and not be murdered. So when we looked at the victim's side, what I'm looking at is what is going to do best to make that person understand that, yes, they were wronged and the system did the best for me it could, and part of that is serving a full sentence. Just showing that you were safe or you didn't cause a problem in prison is different than being a good citizen again and not being a threat to other people. So by going through the prison, that's step one. And since we have a parole system, going through that next step of actually reestablishing yourself in your community and showing during that period of parole that you are and will be a good and capable citizen, I think that's just very important for the entire for the system to work.
That's Delegate Brett Wilson, Republican, who represents Washington County. Let me introduce Perry Hopkins, who's here with me in the studio. Perry Hopkins is a community organizer and activist who works for Communities United. He's also a former felon. He's been back in the community since 2012. Perry Hopkins, I understand you have finished parole, right?
Yes.
And so you actually are registered to vote.
Yeah, I am. Very, very proudly a registered voter now.
And I understand you were convicted of drug offenses. How much time have you spent in prison?
A total of 19 years. I've served 5 years three times and 4 years once.
So what goes through your mind when you hear Delegate Wilson's comments about what constitutes repaying a debt to society?
This is not a public safety issue, which he made a very good case for. This is an issue of democracy.
When you're
released from prison, you have an automatic responsibility to pay taxes. This country was founded on the premise of taxation with representation. He's not addressing that.
But he makes the point of, he's talking about violent crimes. I assume yours were not.
Please let me say a little bit about violent crimes in the state of Maryland. There are a lot of nonviolent crimes that have been placed under what's called a violent crime statute. There are a lot of crimes where possession of one substance is a misdemeanor, but the same exact amount of another substance, crack and powder cocaine, constitutes a felony. Possession.
And your point?
The word violent. It's, you know, representing the issue the way that
Delegate Wilson
did is a great scare tactic, but it's not dealing with the issue of democracy. That's what our legislators are for.
So what would you say to Delegate Wilson if he were with us?
What I would say to Delegate Wilson is we have the Maryland Division of Correction in place to do the job that he's doing verbally. They decide when you are to be returned and your legal portion of that of your sentence is satisfied enough for you to return. Also, they're painting an ugly face of the ex-felon. I'm an ex-felon. I'm an ugly guy, but I don't have an ugly face. You know, we go to church with you. We worship with you. We sit in restaurants and eat with you. We work with you. Our kids go to school with your kids. We pay taxes. We work. We give back to communities. How about this? We represent legislative districts in the state of Maryland. Should we not have a right to participate in the process? Should we not have a right to vote against laws that oppress us while paying into a system to do so? How about that argument? Felonies. We have a very well-known sportscaster. His name is Ed Norris. He was once the top cop in Baltimore City and was convicted of a felon. Why is not that language being used in reference to that gentleman who's now a prominent sportscaster? We're people. We made mistakes. Do you know about the brilliant minds and all the talent that rest in prison that has now decided to take a different stance with their life and channel that energy into being constructive citizens? Why should we be denied the opportunity to participate in the vote? And lastly, this law keeps us from voting for president. You're disenfranchising over 40,000 Marylanders and 40,000 national votes into a system of democracy, which is supposed to be representatory of all of the citizens, taxpaying citizens, to get the majority result, what the majority wants. But you're excluding this group.
That is Perry Hopkins, an activist and community organizer for Communities United here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the ongoing votes in the Maryland legislature about whether to override Governor Hogan's veto of a bill that would restore voting rights to former felons who are felons who are still on parole or probation. You mentioned, Perry, you mentioned language, and I want to pick that up because I used the same word that you've just used several times. When I was talking to Delegate Wilson, I used the word ex-felon. And he interrupted me and essentially told me that the phrase was inaccurate. He said, an ex-felon is someone who received either a pardon or probation before judgment or had their case overturned through appeal. Just completing the sentence and parole doesn't make you an ex-felon. It's still there, and you still have to deal with it, unfortunately, throughout your life.
You know, that's really that's yeah. You have to deal with it for the rest of your life because you're going to be blackballed by the state of Maryland for the rest of your life. You're not going to be able to get a job. You're not going to be able to apply for housing. You're going to be denied some training. You can't get certain types of vocational license. Yeah, you're right, for the rest of your life. Once again, you're taking a public safety issue. You're trying to make the public feel unsafe in the voting place when that's not what this is about. It's about tax-paying productive citizens, you know, participating in our system of government. If you pay in and you don't have a voice, you're not in a democracy, you're under a dictatorship. Lastly, I'll say this. While you're in prison, you're not responsible for paying taxes because you have no voice. You have no input. How about give us a tax deduction until we finish our sentence? How's that sound?
You are a very compelling speaker, as I assume you know. But I think many people who haven't been close to the situation mm-hmm. that you're in have heard about this issue and sort of think, wait a minute. The voter turnout in most elections is so low. I mean, all kinds of people who mm-hmm. have the right to vote think they're too busy or it doesn't make a difference or it's not important. And I think they think this is okay, this is a symbolic issue, a symbolic debate, but really, even if these folks who've come out of prison had the right to register to vote, how many of them would actually exercise it? Because, all kinds of people don't bother to exercise that right.
Yeah, but all types of people haven't been oppressed this way. All types of people, you get a choice to participate in the system. Some people become complacent with it and don't exercise it. But I will guarantee you a rise in the numbers. I talk to ex-felons every day as I am one, okay? And that community is waiting to exercise this right. To us, it's like a brand new bicycle on Christmas. We can't wait to get on and ride it.
It's your new bike.
New bike.
I want you to hear something else that Delegate Wilson told me. When I asked him why this vote on this override is so clearly along party lines, when there's a whole effort in the legislature in which Republicans and Democrats are working together on bills that would reduce drug sentences, make drug treatment more available, basically looking to save a lot of money by not keeping people in prison so long. Mm-hmm. And here is what Delegate Wilson said about that.
I think all of us down here take very seriously the responsibility to look at the systems in place and determine whether they're delivering the best service they can, not just for the target person, in this case would be the inmates, but also for public safety of all those who haven't committed the crime and are out there. And with justice reinvestment, what you're seeing is we've learned so much about the awful effects of drug addiction and how that can lead to so many different behaviors that would not otherwise be there. So to just have someone sitting in a cell doesn't effectively deal with that. So I think what you're really seeing is that we've gotten facts now about things that work and things that don't work, and we're taking a fresh look at it so that you know, when we spend the people's money, we spend it the most efficient way we can.
That, in the context of this discussion of whether or not to give voting rights, to make voting rights available to people still on probation or parole, that his answer left me a bit confused. And we're almost out of time, but let me get your thoughts when you hear that.
The override of this bill, which we believe very strongly is going to take place and change now, change the history in Maryland, saves the taxpayers of Maryland a great amount of money by simplifying the law. Right now, if I when an ex-felon goes to register, the election board has to run a cross check to find out if whoever's registering is really legally able to vote. It cross-checks through the Division of Correction, and sometimes a flag will show up and a letter will be issued stating that you are not eligible to vote at this time. You won't be eligible to vote until your expiration date. This law is going to eliminate all of those man hours, all of those functions, all of those keystrokes, all of that paper. This is the right thing to do, not only economically, but democratically. And let me say something also, as well as in the span of public safety. Felons who come home and vote don't return 2-1. In Florida, our experiment was taken. Check the numbers. Drastic reduction in repeat offenders.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. I really am grateful to you for coming in.
Sure.
Thanks.
I'm just great to be here. Can I also say to all of you out there, please visit us at communitiesunite.org.
Communities United.
No, Communities Unite.
Communitiesunite.org.
And keep up with what we got going. We're asking you to join the fight. Support us on this because we're all going to make history.
Perry Hopkins, as you can hear, he is a community organizer. He works for Communities United. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. We need to take our first break. And when we return, we'll get an update on conditions on the ground in Syria. Millions of Syrians have been displaced within the country, and some are now facing starvation because rebels have cut off humanitarian aid. We'll hear about the efforts of International Orthodox Christian Charities, which is based here in Baltimore. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us for that. Welcome back to Midday, the Friday News Roundup. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us for this. This week, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, took his first trip to Syria, visiting the capital, Damascus, and meeting with government officials, humanitarian workers, and Syrian citizens. More than 120 humanitarian organizations and UN agencies have signed a letter calling for an end to the Syrian conflict and for unimpeded access to provide assistance throughout the country. Since Syria's civil war began in March 2011, that's almost 5 years ago, 4.6 million Syrians have become refugees, and millions more have been displaced inside Syria. And with me now in the studio is Mark Ohanian. He's director of programs at International Orthodox Christian Charities, which is based in Baltimore. Mark Ohanian oversees more than 400 staff on the ground in the Middle East and directs the organization's response to the Syrian crisis. He also recently returned from Syria himself. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Sheila. Thank you for having me on your show.
So you were just in Syria. What did you see? What's going on?
The usual, which is what we've been seeing the past 5 years. We're actually witnessing the greatest population displacement since World War II, and much of that is attributed to the Syria crisis. And much of the loss of life and the infrastructure that we are hearing about or seeing on our TVs is also, unfortunately, is avoidable, but not much is being done on that. Probably the greatest, visually what you observe mostly, is the services and the infrastructure really depleting in the country. Services to the population, from healthcare to education, they're underfunded. This is in areas that are, excuse me, not directly affected by the war, and people are going by with whatever they can. Their businesses have stopped. They're unable to generate income. They're unable to generate their livelihoods to support themselves and their families. So it's a very difficult situation, and the great majority of the students today are in need in some sort of humanitarian assistance from organizations like ourselves, IOCC, but also other humanitarian agencies. And that is hard to come by. And let's keep in mind that Syria has a population of, used to have a population of 23 million. Now about 4 to 5 million are refugees. So we think in the areas that where we serve as IOCC, we have access to approximately 15, 16 million Syrians. And 75% of them do need some sort of humanitarian assistance.
Take a minute to remind our listeners who IOCC, International Orthodox Christian Charities, is, and tell us briefly what you're doing in Syria.
Mm-hmm. We're a 22, 23-year-old humanitarian faith-based organization of the Orthodox Church, and we have been working in Syria since 2002. But let me also remind ourselves and our listeners that IOCC also works in Africa, in addition to the Middle East, in the Balkans, in Greece, in Serbia, in Bosnia, in Republic of Georgia, and other places where there are emergencies and humanitarian aid is needed. Particularly in Syria, we've been there since 2002. We've increased our work in Syria in 2007 when, after the Iraq war, where we had a lot of Iraqi refugees coming into Syria. So we've increased our programming there. And then in 2012, with the onset of this emergent, this current crisis, Syrian crisis that started in 2011, and humanitarian needs became to the surface and pretty dire in early 2012, we shifted our operations in providing more emergency assistance in Syria for those affected by the conflict. And since then, since 2012, we've programmed over $100 million to support the Syrian displaced and host population inside Syria and the refugees outside, primarily in Lebanon and Jordan.
Primarily in Lebanon and Jordan. We hear so much about the risk of starvation, about the people just not having enough to eat in Syria, and especially in Madaya, if am I pronouncing that correctly?
Madaya, correct.
Madaya, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there was, I think, a brief period when some humanitarian aid was allowed to get in, but it's still somewhat restricted. Tell us what's going on there and whether you're having any impact on places where people are starving.
Unfortunately, the parties of war, they're using this tactic as a weapon of war, the siege and such, which is what you're referring to. What I can say from our part is we're working in a very difficult operating environment in the areas where we work. There are some places that we are unable to have access, and Madaya is an example of that. So we are unable to enter because that's highly controlled, and the UN agencies are actually negotiating with the Syrian government, and they have, I understand, just recently have given got assistance inside. The same thing is happening on the other side of the conflict. There are many pockets around Syria, and both sides of the conflict are actually using the siege as a weapon of war, as a tactic of war, which is unacceptable, of course. What we're doing from our side is, and this has happened actually in the past in earlier instances, when population gets out of those areas, we stand ready to support them, but we are unable to go inside simply because it's a highly controlled environment, and it's only the UN agency that in the specific pockets are able to negotiate access in those pockets.
But you're doing a lot with nutrition in Syria.
Absolutely.
I gather. Tell me what you are doing and where you can do it.
We're covering the needs in large parts of Syria, from the north and northeast Hasaki, which is the eastern part of Syria, to Latakia, coastal area, Tartus, to Damascus and suburbs of Damascus, and all the way to the south in Dara. Our activities are there's just a wide range of activities that we're involved in. Primarily shelter, food assistance, non-food assistance, especially focusing on those who are recently displaced, who have been recently displaced from their homes. Water assistance is key, which we're doing a lot of that these days, in the past couple of years, in fact, just to remind ourselves that we have population swelling in various communities in Syria. If there used to be 5,000 in a particular town, now the IDPs, the internally displaced that came in, the population has grown multifold. In some places, from 5,000 it grew to 15,000 to 20,000. So with that, the infrastructure, we support the infrastructure of being able to provide water, giving the people access to education and healthcare and so forth, including nutrition, of course.
That is Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs at International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC, which is based here in Baltimore. He's just returned from Syria, and he's catching us up on the situation there. You know, some people hear you describe how bleak things are, and since we have seen on television and read in the newspapers so much about refugees who've left Syria, people may be wondering, why do people stay?
Short answer is they're stuck. If you look at the geography and the developments in recent weeks in Syria and the neighboring countries around Syria, Turkey, for example, has just instituted a visa regime. So Syrians, in order for them to flee to Turkey and then from there to Europe, now they need a visa. So it has become extremely difficult for them to leave Syria. Same thing is true, can be said, in the southern and southeastern borders of Syria with Lebanon and Jordan. Both of those countries have also instituted visa regimes since early 2015, and it has become very, very difficult for them to cross the borders. And on the east, it's Iraq. It's ISIS-controlled territories. Of course, Syrians do not want to go to ISIS areas. On the contrary, they're trying to flee those areas. And on the west, there's the Mediterranean Sea. So really, the options are very limited for the Syrians. And those who are able to get themselves out via mostly illegal means, it's costing them a lot of money. They're borrowing a lot of money to do that. And I'll tell you a story, actually, of a woman that I met in Homs recently. We were actually repairing their home when she had returned to her home. We were providing minor support, home repair. And she said her elder son had just left to Turkey, trying to find his way going into Sweden. Her younger son, who was studying still in university, in Homs University, he had two more years to finish. And she told me something that was striking. She said, I hope he will fail and he will study much longer than the 2 years, because she knows that when he graduates, he doesn't have any prospect to stay in Syria, that he will emigrate. He will do the same thing just like his older brother and find a way to leave the country. And of course, as a mother, she wants him to stay. But that's the choices that the Syrians are facing. If you stay, you don't have a prospect, you don't have a future, you don't have a job, and you're unsafe. And also, if you leave, you're just leaving your country, you're leaving your roots. And that's the dilemma that Syrians, the majority of the Syrians, face.
What does the winter weather add to the problems? How does that show up?
It makes it worse in many ways with the Syrians, and I think one of the signs that we're seeing, the negative coping mechanism that Syrians go to, and what that is, in one instance, for instance, in the suburbs of Damascus, with the winter weather, the heating, of course, there's heating, fuel is very difficult to come by, and it's extremely expensive to have access to. Many families, they're using compressed plastic bags that is being sold for really about 70 Syrian pounds or 100 Syrian pounds, which is approximately 20 cents or 30 cents per kilo. That's being used to burn inside their homes and as a way to heat themselves. The danger in that is those compressed plastic bags that they're burning, it produces cancerogenic fumes.
And
that's what people are exposed to. So this is what we call the negative coping mechanism, because they do not have another choice to keep themselves warm. They resort to these kind of measures that makes it extremely dangerous for them. It may heat them that evening or that day, but the consequences of that, the long-term consequences, is even greater for them. So we do, from our side, we do provide heating fuel. But again, we need to be realistic. There are millions of Syrians who are in need of assistance. If I can say, you can have all the humanitarian funds of the world and of the governments and the agencies together to assist the Syrians. it will not be able to meet the basic, all of the needs of the students. That's the harsh reality for us today. While great work is being done by ourselves and many other agencies in Syria and outside of Syria, I think what we really need to put our efforts on, the international community, to try to put an end to this conflict. We know there's negotiations next week for the Syrian crisis. Unfortunately, there's not much hope coming out of that, but more efforts really need to be put so that this conflict is stopped, because the world, all of us, cannot sustain the needs that we are seeing in Syria today. And I think every day that passes, Syrians, or the majority of Syrians, are resorting to these negative coping mechanisms, and it's making it harder and harder for them to get by.
What do Syrians tell you when you talk to them when you're there? I mean, how do they view what's going on, and these negative coping mechanisms?
Disappointment, lack of hope. Disappointment towards the international community. It's very obvious to Syrians, and I think to non-Syrians as well, that this has become a proxy war by regional and international powers, and the Syrians are just going a victim of that. And I think if you ask Syrians, before they ask for a food basket or a hygiene packet, they want the war to stop. Because everybody understands that if this war does not stop, if there's some sort of settlement, their situation will not become normal. And that's unfortunately the sad reality today. And that's where I think we think a lot of the effort and the focus should go on in stopping this war.
I watched one of the videos that you have on the IOCC website that said something, perhaps I sort of knew the numbers but hadn't actually thought of this. Half of Syria's children are refugees?
That's correct. And if you take that also on the refugee side, for example, when the Syrian children's in Lebanon, and half of the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, for instance, do not have to formal education. When you have such high displacement inside Syria, when you have millions of people, for example, going from one place to another place, the infrastructure in the host community is unable to cope with the incoming population. This is a perfect example in the coastal areas, for example, in Syria and other parts of the major urban areas. So you have populations, a lot of families are unable to send their kids to school because they're either away from school locations or they cannot afford the basic transportation. Maybe it will cost $1 or $2 to send them to school every day. They don't have access to that. As a result, they stay home. That's another negative coping mechanism. And if they are able to send them, it's limited to a number of people because the infrastructure in the receiving community inside Syria is unable to host all of them, all of the children. So as a result, many children do stay without access to education.
IOCC is also on the ground in Lebanon and Jordan. You mentioned countries that border Syria. How are they coping?
The host countries are making it very difficult as well for the Syrian refugees. Of course, they have their own reasons, but economic reasons. These countries that are very vulnerable themselves, their infrastructure is extremely weak. But of course, that's not an excuse not to support these families. So NGOs, ourselves as IOCC and other groups, are playing a big role in that. In that, we're supporting the infrastructure of the education and the health system in those countries. We're working with the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education in improving the school infrastructure, rehabbing those schools. Keep in mind that half of the children in Lebanese schools today who are going to public school are Syrian refugees who are attending. There are schools that are working two shifts and sometimes three shifts in some places. So we're investing a lot in rebuilding schools in those places. And the same thing with the healthcare system. We're addressing the issues of malnutrition, tracking the cases of malnutrition and treating them accordingly, providing training to the Ministry of Health workers in those rural areas where large number of Syrian refugees are located. In addition to that, we're also working with the special minority communities who are in Lebanon, but also inside Syria and also in Jordan. They're especially vulnerable. I will take the example of the Assyrian community really taken the brunt of this conflict from coming from the northeastern part of Syria and on the border with Iraq, when they were kicked out by ISIS and they sought refuge in either Damascus or Beirut or in Amman. And we are helping them in those three locations in providing them the basic support and also including access to education. The Assyrian population, for example, I'm just using this as an example. It just exemplifies how small religious minority community, vibrant before the conflict, has really it's decimated right now. They're spread across, and right now they're trying to find ways in reaching Western Europe. They don't find. They're unable to be safe in Syria today anymore, which is why we see them just going. This is a population that has been in Syria, rooted there for hundreds and hundreds of years. So we're doing whatever we can from our part in supporting this community as well.
I really appreciate your giving us this view, as depressing as it is. We need to wrap up, but is there a thought you'd like to leave people with about the situation in Syria?
The conflict has taken a big toll, I think, on the Syrian population. Again, that's one example that I would like to give. Actually, it's a woman that I met in her mid 50s. She was residing in Raqqa, and she has sought refuge in coastal areas, and she was seeking psychosocial support from us as part of our support to her. She said, for the first time in my life, I had to hide my religious identity. She said she's a Christian herself. And this is when ISIS was knocking the doors and trying to identify who is Christian and who is non-Christian. And her response was, I am Syrian. And she refused to say whether she was Christian or non-Christian. The point I'd like to make here that the religious pluralism in Syria today is in danger. And this is one of the greatest irreversible damage that we can do to that society. So I think we need to do whatever we can to maintain that religious pluralism in that country. And also we have a duty as countries, as Western nations, Europe, United States, and others, to do whatever we can to try to bring this peace and stability to that country.
And people who want to learn more can learn a lot from your website, iocc.org. There's a lot of information there about what you're doing and about how people can help. Mark Ohanian, I really appreciate your sharing this information with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. I appreciate it. Thank you.
We need to take a break. When we get back, we're going to talk to Joanna Sullivan of the Baltimore Business Journal about their big stories this week, and with Amanda Serafini of the Maryland Humane Society. Tips, 10 cold weather tips for pet owners. Stay with us for that. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Most Fridays, we are joined by the Baltimore Business Journal to give us the scoop on some of the biggest business and real estate development stories around town. And today, the BBJ's editor-in-chief, Joanna Sullivan, joins us by phone. Joanna, welcome back to Midday.
Oh, thanks, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
The story of the day, of course, the story of the next few days, no doubt, will be this blizzard. What does it mean in a business sense for the Baltimore region?
For business, it's tough. They're going to lose a lot of business, whether it's through productivity or in the terms of restaurants, sales. People aren't going to travel. They're going to be home. They've been stocking up. So it's been great for the grocery stores if you've been shopping.
I was in Home Depot this morning, and they're doing a bang-up business in ice melt and flashlights and things like that.
So there's, you know, a good and the bad for business, but most of all, it's going to really, you know, it's going to hurt. Luckily, it's on a weekend, so that makes it a little bit easier. But if you're flying, forget it. Your trip is probably canceled. You have nearly 200 flights canceled out of BWI. So, you know, I've already heard from people who were planning on leaving, you know, either today or tomorrow. Forget it. There's no getting out.
So, moving on to some of the news that did happen, you wrote the cover story this week, correct?
No, I did not. Actually, Melody Simmons did. It's on Toby Bizzuto, who's the CEO of the Bizzuto Group. And she talked to him about his growing apartment empire. You know, he's basically building all over the place now, not just Baltimore. He's very prominent in Baltimore. He built the Fitzgerald, Union Wharf in Fells Point, Spinnaker Bay in Harbor East. But he's also, you know, going elsewhere. He's New England, North Carolina, they're eyeing Atlanta, Florida, Chicago. So he's definitely on the move, and he sees, you know, the rental market not changing. In fact, he's waiting for all these millennials who are still living in their parents' basements to move out and get their own apartments.
So he doesn't see an expansion of the rental market?
No, he definitely sees an expansion. He sees it. It's going to keep growing. So he's catering to that growth and planning for that growth.
What were you putting your reporting time into this week?
Yesterday I did a story about the gallery in downtown Baltimore. The gallery was, I was in there and I noticed like some stores were closing, and I talked to some of the merchants there, and the fourth floor is basically being vacated of its retail and food tenants, and they're going to be turning that into office space. So that's a big change. So the gallery's always been like the main shopping, you know, mall in the city. And so you're going to see a lot of changes. The food court's going to be gone and more space devoted to office. I just got a communication from General Growth Properties, which owns the mall, and they said that they're going to be doing that, and they've asked a lot of tenants to leave now. Some of the tenants I talked to are not so happy.
So, I mean, has Gallery been hit by construction in Harbor East and Harbor Point being developed? Is that part of what's behind this?
You know, they really would not elaborate on the reasons why they're turning it into office. You know, over the years, you've seen stores come and go there. Obviously, Harbor East has a lot of great shopping. The gallery shopping has diminished, although they did get Michael Kors and Pandora store. Both high-end stores have moved in the last 2 years. But they're losing. The Ann Taylor is leaving there. A Talbots had left a couple of years ago. So the shopping choices for downtown workers have definitely diminished.
The gallery is close to the harbor, and in certain areas it actually does have harbor views, but not generally. Is that part of what hurts it?
You know, in terms of the retail, I think, you know, a lot of downtown shoppers, it attracts a lot of downtown shoppers and tourists as well. And, you know, overall, you know, everything has been hit, you know, this year in terms of retail. It's right across the street from Harbor Place. Harbor Place is undergoing a lot of changes as well in terms of what is in both pavilions, and we'll probably see even more changes there.
BBJ also had a story about what's next for the Pepsi plant along the Jones Falls.
Yes, you know, everyone knows it by the sign, you know, if you're driving up 83. The Pepsi plant will eventually move. It's going to be there probably through the end of the year, and it's going to be a, you know, mixed-use development, and which they're still in the planning process, but, you know, once the Pepsi plant moves to White Marsh, we could see stores and, you know, retail there, and it's going to be a transit-oriented mixed-use development, which the light rail stop is right there, so which is definitely a trend in development.
Mm-hmm. Real quickly, before I let you go, Jonathan Munshaw, your associate editor, wrote a piece about the capital budget that Governor Hogan unveiled, including $315 million for university construction projects. What's the highlight there?
Well, I think that's probably great news for anyone who's attending. You know, University of Towson is getting a lot in that budget. Mm-hmm. It's great for the construction industry, which we cover very closely. So there's a lot of projects in there that they can jump onto. And We have, it also includes University of Maryland College Park. It's $168 million to continue construction of a bioengineering building. So the university's really, you know, growing and expanding its reputation in engineering and STEM. So that's another big boost. And then we'll see $23 million to start renovation of the Langsdale Library at University of Baltimore.
So there's lots going on there. I appreciate you bringing us up to date, Joanna. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, and stay safe this weekend.
You too. Joanna Sullivan is editor-in-chief of the BBJ. And as she mentioned, stay safe this weekend. Obviously, everyone is focused on the blizzard, expected 20 to 30 inches of snow coming over the weekend, beginning this afternoon or this evening. We know the standard preparation for snowstorms: stock up on bread and toilet paper, make some tea or hot chocolate, ensure there's a bottle or two of your favorite wine. But what about your pets? Joining here with me in the studio to tell us about the most important things you should know for your animals during the snowstorm is Amanda Serafini.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the show. You are veterinary training and behavior director and registered vet tech at the Baltimore Humane Society. So you're the perfect person to tell us. Are some dogs sort of truly in their element in this kind of weather? I mean, is it as scary for pets as it is for some of us humans?
Sure. So I guess it depends on the pet. You know, the dogs that have those thick undercoats, this is the type of weather that they just love. Dogs like shepherds, huskies, things like that, breeds of that nature. Albeit they should still be kept indoors, because the rule of thumb is if it's too cold for you to be outside, it's too cold for you to keep your pet outside. Especially dogs with the shorter coats should wear, you know, jackets and things like that to keep them warm.
Okay. What about clothes for pets?
Clothes, absolutely. If their coats are too short, you know, to keep the warmth in, then you should layer up, especially if you're going to be taking them outside for walks and things of that nature.
I think about all the things that we use to melt snow and ice, chemicals, mm-hmm. salt,
yes.
for starters.
Yes.
Tell us what pet owners should be aware about all of that.
Avoid the road salt and salt that goes down on the sidewalk as much as possible. That is actually, if ingested by your pet, can be toxic, and it is also irritating to the tissue that the paw pads are made out of. So what we recommend to do is that after walks, wipe off their paws with a lukewarm towel so that they don't come inside and ingest it by licking it off their paws. Or you can prevent them from making contact with it at all by either purchasing little pet slippers or booties for their paws, or applying a layer of petroleum jelly or Vaseline to the bottom of their paws too, to act as a barrier.
And antifreeze.
Antifreeze. Antifreeze is a big one. You know, we're using it in our cars, you know, anything that would use antifreeze. Antifreeze is a product that is extremely toxic to pets, but unfortunately it's very tempting to them because of the sweet taste that it has.
Yeah.
So if a pet does ingest antifreeze, or if you even suspect that a pet has ingested antifreeze, we recommend you get them to a veterinarian immediately. And of course, you want to make sure that you store antifreeze in an appropriate spot high up in an airtight container that is spill-proof.
We're almost out of time, but I want to pick up on something you said about if it's too cold for you to be outside, probably is for your pet too. So pets spending a lot of time indoors going to be pretty bored, right?
Yeah, so your dogs and even cats can get really bored indoors if they're not getting the appropriate amount of exercise. So it is a good idea to up the amount of enrichment that they get, things like frozen Kongs, food puzzles, and even training games, just to keep their mental energy expended so that way they won't turn on your furniture or anything like that.
One last thought? Something to leave people with?
You know, cuddle up. It's the perfect time to, you know, get snuggly with your pet while we're indoors for who knows how long with this snow that's coming.
Thank you so much. And Amanda Serafini, veterinary training and behavior director and registered vet tech at the Baltimore Humane Society. I really appreciate your coming in.
Thank you.
Stay safe this weekend.
Thanks, you too.
And I want to thank all of our guests today. And I want to thank you for tuning in. Midday, we'll be back on Monday. We have every intention of being here. We'll be talking about bygone blizzards, and we want to hear your snow stories, from storms past to what's happened this time. Were you holed up with a can of beans and no can opener? Did you sled down the interstate? Send your snow stories to midday@wypr.org or post to the WYPR Facebook page. We'll share some of them on Monday's show, and we hope you'll join us then. Here and Now is next. I'm Sheila Cast, hoping you have a safe weekend and stay warm.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.